Barak Richman is a professor of law and business at Duke University. He teaches and specializes in healthcare policy. Wisconsin, I asked him to take time out from his Madison schedule to discuss healthcare in our state and the nation. Professor, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You're here talking to the Wisconsin Association of Health Plans.
We spoke this morning. I give a talk. It was largely interactive, so I think that I was also talked to. But it was very collaborative and it was very constructive. It was terrific.
Healthcare, where do we start? Let's start here. Wisconsin is consistently ranked among the top in healthcare. But it's also, especially in Milwaukee, some of the most expensive healthcare. Do they have to go together? Why is it that, yeah, okay, we cheeseheads are healthy, but we're also facing very high costs? Why?
Well, it certainly doesn't have to go together. And for the most part, it goes in the opposite direction. So you have in Wisconsin a highly competitive insurance market.
We do.
And you also have a lot of fairly affordable care. There is, I understand, a lot of consolidation that's happening in Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. But not in the rest of the state. And it's that combination of dynamism, insurance competition and provider competition, that actually generates some fairly high-value care.
Well, I know you specialize in competition. So it's news to me that Wisconsin is a very competitive market. But here's the question. Is there a big disparity, our urban areas versus our rural areas?
So there is a disparity? Hospital markets tend to be local markets.
Okay.
So every market, every hospital market has different concentration metrics. And it happens quite frequently that you have a highly competitive market right next to one that's less competitive. The metrics that I've seen, and look, maybe this is a commentary on the rest of the country, the metrics that I've seen is that Milwaukee is not a terribly terribly concentrated place. Now, nationwide, we've seen consolidation happening at a really alarming rate starting in the early 80s, the mid 80s. The majority of local hospital markets in the country are now highly concentrated, according to a metric established by the Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission. I understand that some acquisitions in Milwaukee has followed that trend. My understanding is that the rest of Wisconsin has not followed that trend. The trend in of itself does not make Milwaukee unique at all. And the truth is that the costs in other parts of the country are much higher than in Wisconsin, in large part because the concentration is higher also.
Do you think the M&A trend in Milwaukee is one reason for the higher costs, even though vis-a-vis it may not be as high as in other metro areas?
So I haven't studied the Milwaukee market with great care. My understanding is the answer is yes.
Okay.
In large part, I'm relying on the fair truism that if there's less competition, more consolidation, you're going to have higher prices. Now, of course, prices have been increasing above the rate of insurance nationwide anyway. Consolidation has been a very significant contributor to that pattern. But we have other things we have to fix also.
Well, let's talk about a news story just this week in Wisconsin. Wisconsin's uninsured rate fell by one-third in the past 2 years, from 9.1% in 2013 to 5.7% in 2015. We went from 518,000 uninsured to 323, sixth best in the nation. Was this a victory for Governor Walker's decision to not take the federal cash and expand MA, but cover everybody below 100% of poverty?
It's interesting. Uninsurance rates have gone down nationwide. Of course, because of the Affordable Care Act. It's no longer, you get penalized if you don't have insurance. So we've seen the uninsurance rate going down everywhere. Now, that's not necessarily a victory in of its own. And what we want to figure out is how we are expending healthcare effectively, whether we're actually purchasing value. I will say that some exchanges have been working more effectively than others in the sense that they have not only more offerings on them, but they also have attracted more subscribers. So in some states, exchanges have been very effective in reducing the uninsurance rate, and some states less so. But there are other ways that the uninsurance rate has gone down also. And one way has been to try to figure out how to calibrate Medicaid expansion as well. So let me put it this way. Uninsurance rate has gone down everywhere. There are lots of different ways to get there. And ultimately, what we're really trying to do in terms of evaluating what policies are success is trying to figure out when value is being purchased. I think it's much more important than actually thinking about the uninsurance rate as a metric on its own.
In the wake of our insurance rate falling, the governor's office put out a statement, of course, declaring victory. Is there an other side to this that our viewers should know?
Short answer is I don't know. I do not know about the assorted mechanisms that the Walker administration has pursued to reduce the uninsurance rate. I do know that Wisconsin has one of the lowest uninsurance rates in the country.
And prior to the ACA.
Exactly, and I know that Wisconsin did before also.
Only after Massachusetts.
Uh-huh. Well, but which is also kind of funny because Massachusetts, you might say, had the ACA before the ACA.
It was signed by Mitt Romney, wasn't it?
It was signed by Mitt Romney, yeah.
And then we then walked away. But anyway, that's a different story.
I mean, the uninsurance rate is a critical factor as it relates to social justice. You really want to make sure as much as your population has access to insurance as possible. That's the goal that everybody has. But it's not the only goal that healthcare policymakers have to have. We call it the triple aim: access, cost, and quality. But what we're really trying to do is not just expand insurance and protection, financial protection, but we're trying to make sure that we use our dollars effectively. So I would say that there are not many places anywhere. I'll say there is no place yet that can declare victory because we still really haven't purchased value as predominantly as we really should. We need to make sure that we institute more reforms, more value-enhancing reforms to the delivery system. It's not just the uninsurance rate that we're worried about.
Had you been testifying in the Wisconsin Capitol on whether we should take the federal money and expand MA, how would you have counseled our lawmakers?
This is not a very helpful answer.
Thank you for saying that up front.
If the federal government is offering us significant dollars to doing something, I would figure out a way to get the dollars.
Okay.
I really would, whether it's for transportation or national security or health insurance. I would figure out a way to do it. I do not think that under any of those circumstances, whether it's transportation, national security, or health insurance, the strings attached are so debilitating that you really can't do something of value. And I'm from North Carolina, which has not expanded Medicaid, and I would say the same thing there also. There are a lot of ways that you could take the dollars, help your state, help the citizenry, help your budgetary pressures, and still preserve whatever values that you want in your healthcare policy.
Has your uninsured rate also dropped in a similar way to the state of Wisconsin?
I think it's less so. We started off a lot higher. We've gone down because of the Affordable Care Act, but we could go down a lot higher. We could go down a lot more.
When Wisconsin and I covered the governor in this debate, this major policy decision to not take the federal money and expand, he repeatedly said, how can you trust the federal government that's $17 trillion in debt to pay $199, $98, $97? Your answer?
How can you trust the federal government?
Yeah, that they're going to make good on the promises to cover the cost of expanding.
I mean, you know, the federal government is, you know, the federal government is more trustworthy than any government in the world because it has the, you know, it has the credibility of the dollar behind it. It's not obligated to fix a balanced budget. Now, political winds change, decisions change, but I would be surprised to describe it as a matter of trust. Healthcare policy is a two-way street. In fact, actually, I think most meaningful healthcare policies happen at the state level. I understand a lot of dollars come from the federal level, but in terms of constructing what sort of delivery systems you have, the personnel that you can offer in a healthcare delivery system, how you can construct insurance products, all that happens at the state level. And I don't think that it's really a question of trust. I think it's a matter of just coming up with constructive relationships and pursuing good policies.
Have states that accept it, your state has not, the federal money and expand it, haven't they seen tremendous cost overruns
in
their MA programs?
We've seen cost overruns everywhere because we have lots of people who are having insurance for the first time. And it was probably unpredicted. I would actually say that it was unpredicted a little. It could have been predicted a lot more effectively. But they have a lot of latent costs that they're consuming. They're seeing doctors for the first time. They're having unmet needs met for the first time. So you have a lot of initial costs, and you have the prices aren't quite right yet. There's no question about it. The insurance products that are being offered do not reflect the costs that the subscribers are imposing on the insurance companies. So we have some significant adjustments, both in the private market and in the Medicaid market. Now, how you respond is really the next question. It's the important question. The prevailing narrative has been the way we respond is by increasing rates. And the regulators need to allow the insurance companies to increase rates, or similarly for Medicaid, we have to cut back. The feds have to allow us to cut back on the generosity or increase the subsidies. And I would argue that the real challenge is to change the kind of insurance product and delivery system that we have. We should not continue to funnel dollars down insurance products that are really expensive. We have to come up with more valuable insurance products.
I interview a lot of candidates, especially with the November 8 elections coming up. And many of them say, blame health insurers as the great evil in this debate nationally. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't think that's correct. I neither think it's correct to blame insurers. I also don't think it's helpful to blame insurers. Now, insurers are an easy target because they're the ones that basically tell patients either that they have to copay or that they can't assume the care that they want to get. They're kind of left saying no, and that's why I think they make for an easy target. The truth is that the reason we spend an extraordinary amount of health care is because we have payment systems that really aren't managed. There's still a prevailing amount of fee-for-service in the country, which means basically the doctors perform whatever they think is necessary and get paid for whatever price they think is appropriate. A lot of the care that people are getting are not worth the value, and a lot of the care that people are getting is probably the wrong care they should be getting. We need to figure out ways to direct people towards more valuable care. Now, that's what insurers, if they're doing their job, are doing, directing patients towards high-quality care, high-quality providers. It's a very difficult position to be in with this prevailing narrative that the insurers are the ones that say no.
Yes.
We really need to change that narrative. We have to have some kind of partnership between consumers and insurers where insurers are navigating and empowering consumers to get the care they really need while also economizing on their costs. I think that narrative is changing. I really do. In part because insurers are doing more navigating, doing more managing. It's not the old days of managed care where you need authorization before you do everything. A lot of it's more proactive. There's the use of data and mobile technologies to really empower consumers. There's also a way to inform consumers that none of this is a blank check. It's all coming out of your premiums. And if you economize with me, I'm going to save you money. So I think it's wrong to blame insurers. I certainly think insurers can be doing things better writ large, and some insurers are doing things a lot better than other insurers. But by no means do we have a system where the insurers are the only ones to blame. But I also think it's really unhelpful. I think that serious policymakers would not blame insurers. I think they'd be thinking more critically, more creatively about policy solutions.
You mentioned the concept of the informed consumer, which has always intrigued me.
Yeah.
Because about 5 or 6 years ago, I remember a comment from a Democratic state senator, Kathleen Vinehout, who supports universal health care. And she said, look, when my son had appendicitis, I couldn't call up Mayo and Marshfield and say, are you having a sale? And that just sticks with me. So that goes back to the blaming insurers. Any thoughts on her comment, even though it was 5 or 6 years ago?
So we need the health system to be more cost conscious. There's no question about that. One way to facilitate cost consciousness is to publicize prices, have consumers aware of all those prices, And then you would think that providers actually would have sales and would compete on price. I wrote a paper on heart hospitals in India, where the market is very different. But you have a lot of you have a middle class in India that is larger than our entire country. Very few of them have insurance. All of them pay for healthcare out of their pockets. So they're very cost conscious, but they need healthcare. And you have these heart hospitals competing on price. You actually do have sales for bypass surgeries. February is bypass surgery month. So that is one way that that you can bring value and price competition by empowering consumers. Consumers pay the last dollar and forcing price disclosure. By no means is it the only way, and by no means would I ever say that the United States should writ large adopt India's healthcare system. But there have been mechanisms to try to figure out how to have patients bear that last dollar and make decisions accordingly. And if, in fact, patients did pay that assume the responsibility for that last dollar, then you probably would see the Mayos and Marshfields making things more attractive and not just hiding the costs and charging people afterwards, and by no means are they exceptional. You might have more transparency. But the other strategy, of course, is to team up with an insurer that creates a certain network. And there are other associated efficiencies there, too. You might have less consumer choice. You might have significant consumer choice across insurers. But once you're within a network, you're largely directed. And the insurer, which has data and has long-term relationships with providers, they make your decisions for you. That's another way to bring choice to the system. You're choosing among networks and not among specific procedures. For the most part, most of our country has neither of those systems, where you have indemnity insurance and no price competition.
If people are not blaming health insurers, they're blaming Big Pharma.
Yeah.
The EpiPen controversy.
Yeah.
Talking to my neighbor yesterday, who has been diagnosed with cancer and is in hospice, his doctor prescribed a pill that cost $800 a pill three times a day. Talk to me about the role of Big Pharma. Are they white hat, black hat, gray hat in this debate?
It's irresponsible to talk about Big Pharma without talking about some of the enormously valuable innovations they've made. It's just not fair.
I concede that.
Having said that, we need a lot more competition between branded drugs and between branded and generic drugs. The reason we have high prices, especially the EpiPen, so many high prices in pharma is because there's not active and thoughtful competition. Now, some services truly are unique and irreplaceable, and those are really expensive. You know, the pharma companies exploit their market power as much as they can, and if they produce something that is truly valuable and truly innovative and they're unique, the law, and I would think market dynamics, would support that. That's much the exception than the norm, though. The norm is the EpiPen, where because of marketing and because of the failure of generics, and because of, frankly, the failure of intelligent providers and intermediaries to shop across products, that's why we have the higher prices. So you could have a system where the patient bears all the costs and the patient does these sorts of price comparisons. That's very difficult to do in the pharma space. Very, very difficult to do. But if we have a system where providers and insurers are very aggressive in doing comparative effectiveness research, in saying to patients, we are not going to give you the branded drug, we're going to give you the generic, it's one-tenth the price, it might be half as good, but it's one-tenth the price, then we would have a much more reasonable expenditures on pharma. You can't blame pharma for coming up with good stuff. You can't blame them for coming up for getting patents. You can blame them for trying to manipulate the FDA system, for extending their patents, for doing what's called product hopping, for trying to foreclose generic competition, for pay for delay. The pharma folks do lots of bad stuff, but a lot of that bad stuff would be mitigated if we purchased healthcare in a more intelligent way.
Should Medicare be allowed to negotiate drug discounts?
I think that's...
Former Secretary Tommy Thompson told me they should after we left office. Go ahead. Excuse me.
Well, that's interesting. I would like to see, instead of a Medicare officer comparing prices, I would like to see really vibrant competition and regulatory flexibility on Medicare Part D, which is different. Medicare Part D is basically the government gives the beneficiary a check, you purchase insurance, and the insurer, the intermediary, makes intelligent decisions for you and negotiates aggressively with providers. Now, that's a theory. It doesn't work in practice for a lot of reasons that I don't think anybody understands. There's not enough substitution in Medicare Part D programs. There's not enough generic substitution and also product substitution. You don't always see dollars going in the most valuable towards the most valuable services. Some people think it has something to do with what happens, you know, in the back offices, relationships between Medicare Part D companies and GPOs, and none of that's disclosed. So we don't know. As a theoretical matter, I would rather see more of a voucher system, which is, I think, what Medicare Part D really is. But we're not really seeing the benefits of that voucher system the way we would like.
Do I hear echoes of Speaker Ryan's plan in that, vouchers?
For drugs, I think the voucher plan is a good idea. For Medicare, I'm on record as having said that the Ryan plan is not a good idea, only because the projected price increases for healthcare so far outstrip whatever the vouchers could possibly keep up with. And we really would be subjecting our future elderly to poverty because the voucher wouldn't be able to keep up. That's another way of saying we need to deal with the cost of healthcare much, you know, alongside trying to think of how we finance it.
1 in 5 Wisconsin residents get their healthcare through Medicaid. Just today, the Secretary of Department of Health Services asked in her budget request for the next 2 years an additional $450 million. That's equal to half if we raised our sales tax from 5 to 6, half of that would go. What choices do our legislators face in, I'm going to use the trite term, bending the cost curve? Don't we both hate that? Okay, cost controls over a Medicaid program that now provide health care to 1 in 5 Wisconsin residents, and as we boomers age in place, the future funding has been called unsustainable. So the future options for our policymakers on MA?
And it's a microcosm of the larger problems, but it's happening on a state budget that can't run a deficit and a vulnerable population that can't do a lot of price sharing and has a lot of health care costs. It's a really hard problem. Now, I'll say again, it's a microcosm of the larger problem where we're just spending money that's unsustainable and just crowding out all of our additional all investments in education and transportation and the like. That's happening not just to state budgets, but also to families and to businesses, and maybe even Medicare itself will go bankrupt. Now, that's just reaffirming how important the question is. So I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. I mean, I do know. I'll tell you what this. I do know that we can invest in healthcare more intelligently. I think for the most part, Medicaid managed care has been ahead of the curve, which might make economizing harder for those populations, harder for those products. But I also know that that there are studies suggesting that investments in education reduce healthcare costs more, than the investment in education itself. We really need to think about social policy more categorically, more seamlessly, not just in terms of healthcare, but we need healthcare, education, safety, and actually the truth is, the Dallas police commissioner said it very eloquently, police are trying to do too much. I think you might say that Medicaid managed care is trying to do too much also. We have to think about these problems categorically.
What about the role of for-profit organizations in controlling Medicaid costs? I just read this fascinating story in the New York Times. California has changed its law to allow for-profit. Your thoughts on that?
I mean, it depends on how it's run. I mean, there is no reason to vilify for-profit providers, insurers. In fact, actually, there's lots of evidence that for-profit providers, and to some degree, for-profit providers are more judicious in how they spend their excesses, their profit margins. I think that in the healthcare sector, nonprofits, for the most part, act very much like for-profits. So therefore, the shift from nonprofit to for-profit doesn't signal anything really significant to me.
let's review.
Now, let me say, that's as a general matter. There are a lot of nonprofits that are deeply steeped into communities where their nonprofit status really does matter. Matters to the whole framework of their organization. And that's worth celebrating. But that's, I think, much more the exception. I imagine not necessarily the worry that California had when it shifted to for-profits in their Medicaid program.
6 years later, biggest achievement of the Affordable Care Act, the 20 million Americans that have health care? Is that too simplistic a question?
The question is, what's the biggest accomplishment of the Affordable Care Act?
Yes. Thank you for asking my question.
I think it's really quite significant that we've extended a lot of insurance to people who haven't had insurance before. I don't want to belittle that at all. I want to emphasize that it certainly isn't the solution, and to some degree exacerbates other problems. You might say that if we look at Massachusetts as the precursor, Massachusetts had like everybody else, an access, quality, and cost problem. You say insurance and quality and cost problem. They decided to focus on the access problem, which you might say the Affordable Care Act really focuses on the access problem first also. That exacerbated Massachusetts' cost and quality problem.
Yes.
You might even say we are now running faster towards the ledge of cost on sustainability. Some people think that the Massachusetts plan was deliberate. Now we really need to talk about costs, whereas before we were putting it off. I won't comment on the wisdom of that strategy. I'm just happy that Massachusetts now is talking about costs, and they are. But it just illustrates you can't talk about access and insurance coverage alone. You just can't. I think the biggest accomplishment for the Affordable Care Act is to create the framework of exchanges. I think that once we get an exchange, whether it's run by the state, whether it's run by the Fed, whether it's run by a private company also, and that's possible as well, it gives us an opportunity to purchase health insurance in an entirely different way. It can facilitate a lot of price competition. It can empower consumers. In many ways, a long time coming. We were purchasing airplane tickets on exchanges on the internet long before healthcare, and it really brought a lot of competition. I think that's the legacy. That so far is the most lasting achievement of the ACA, but we really need to build off it. An exchange isn't very valuable if you only have one provider on it.
That's where I was going next. ACA seems at this amazing crossroads with huge providers dropping out and some of these providers who stay in hitting states with 15, 16, 20%. And what is it, 17 or 19% of the nation may only have zero or one provider? So it is at a crossroads, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is. Now, because of the importance of establishing exchanges as a framework for competition and a framework for entry also, it really allows new insurers to enter marketplaces. By no means do we want to dismantle the infrastructure. I think the infrastructure is really valuable. But we do have to figure out how to create more choices to encourage people, more insurers, to get on the exchanges. We were talking about it before, the real problem there, that problem illustrates not that the rates aren't right, but that the products aren't right. And we really, especially on the exchanges where there are few offerings, we have to encourage, I'll put it on a demand side story, encourage consumers to purchase affordable insurance products that have narrow networks, that have cost sharing, that really directs them in different places. These are not inferior products. That's what we really need from the exchanges.
Okay, a couple more questions because we're almost out of time. I have to ask a political question.
Okay.
What could, let's ask it both ways. Could a President Trump repeal the Affordable Care Act? Question number one. Could a President Clinton expand it, given what you see in Washington and the gridlock on how to pay bills?
All right, so one question is, can a president do either of those unilaterally?
Yes.
I do not think that a president can unilaterally repeal without congressional approval. If President Trump were to try to repeal with congressional approval, for a budgetary perspective, it would be enormously costly. And from the infrastructure that was built up, it would not be capitalizing on a lot of investments that I think are reasonable. Can President Clinton or President Trump expand unilaterally? I think the answer is yes, not necessarily a good thing. The Obama administration, of course, has been accused of expanding Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, without legislative approval, and it's gotten him in some
through
hot water,
order,
appropriately.
Yeah. Gotten him sued.
Yeah, it's gotten him sued. He's won some of the suits. He's lost a couple of the suits. I mean, healthcare should not, I mean, this is a silly thing to say. Healthcare should not be this partisan. It just shouldn't. Obamacare, at its core, yes, Obamacare has some regulations that pro-market people wouldn't like. Yes, it has some subsidies that pro-market people wouldn't like. The essence of Obamacare is establishing exchanges. Nobody shouldn't dislike that. In fact, it's long overdue. And I don't think that the market could have done that really on its own. There is so much in healthcare that Democrats and Republicans should get together on that it's really quite infuriating. We've all had a disservice done to us because of the partisan rancoring. Nobody should dispute that we need lower cost and higher quality healthcare. No one, frankly, should dispute the value of injecting competition and market forces to doing that, and the Democrats haven't. And no one should dispute the value of having regulators thoughtfully working with the private sector to come up with a meaningful marketplace. So yes, President Clinton could probably expand it on her own. Might not be a good idea. It would be a very, very good idea if she worked with a Republican Congress. It would be a very good idea if a Republican Congress worked with her. And a lot of this stuff just isn't partisan. It just shouldn't be.
Which candidate, Mr. Trump or Secretary Clinton, has put forth the most detailed health care platform?
I'm not saying anything shocking when I say Secretary Clinton has put forward the most detailed plan for anything.
Okay.
And look, that's part of Trump's appeal. It's an avoidance of details.
She has a better understanding of health care policy than Mr. Trump?
I would say that. I would say that she has a better understanding. I would say that she has more details. Now, that's not to say that I would endorse her. Now, full disclosure, I'm a Democrat. I am planning on voting for her. Mm-hmm. But we have a lot of healthcare policy that is not embedded in traditional left-wing values that needs to be done. Our nation has embraced a market orientation to delivering health care. For the most part, most policies have not really harnessed those market forces the way it should. We've allowed monopolies to be formed. We've had lax antitrust enforcement. We have payment policies that don't reward value, that don't facilitate competition. We haven't done a whole lot to empower consumers to really make intelligent decisions. I think the exchanges have the real capacity to do that, but they haven't done that yet. And if I were to think, the next president should do on behalf of healthcare is not a Democratic or Republican story.
Okay.
And I would like to think that if President Trump is the next president, that he has a little common sense, even if he hasn't detailed everything already, a little common sense to figure out how to make the marketplace work as well.
Okay, my final question is this, because we are out of time. If you were talking to the Wisconsin legislature about future healthcare issues in Wisconsin, what advice would you give them? Last question.
I would say that they should realize how exceptional Wisconsin is. Wisconsin is really different from the rest of the country. There is a much more vibrant insurance market here, much more competitive, and healthcare costs and quality are much better than they are in most states, almost sometimes all states. What Wisconsin has built here is something that I would really like to see exported. And I would like to see Wisconsin policymakers, not mess that up, but really be advocates for the kind of healthcare system they've constructed here. There is a lot that the rest of the country can learn from the market structure and the healthcare delivery that Wisconsin has achieved.
Thank you so much. Barack Richmond is a professor of law and business at Duke University Law School. Fascinating discussion. Thanks for stopping in Wisconsin.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.